musical process and world music. Just remember this. Again, these are sort of little primer lessons, not things you don't know, but I just love to say them over and over again. We have three raw materials. The whole world has three raw materials out of which it makes music. It has the overtone series, a gift of God to the human race. It has acoustical laws, that is, laws about the retention and the transmission of sound. And we have the gift of time within which music is made. The visual arts have the color spectrum, and they have space with which these are the raw materials. God didn't create music in a way any more than he created ketchup. That is to say, he created tomatoes and sugar. I mean, even sugar is an artifact because we have to do something with it before it becomes sugar. And we make ketchup out of it. In other words, it's the imago Dei at work with raw materials. So we have ketchup. The imago Dei is at work with the overtone series, which, as you should know or well know, contains every pitch in an infinite upward spiral that we can ever know about. And all music is based on a very small percentage of the lower part of the spectrum of the overtone series. Isn't it amazing that we in Western music only have 12 pitches to work with? Only 12 pitches. And that the music of these past 2,000 years has only used 12 pitches. Our systems don't allow us to step outside of those. Yeah, jazz people can bend notes. Sopranos do without knowing it. Now, you know what the definition of a semitone is? It's two tenors singing in unison. I moved it to another voice ring. But the thing is, can you imagine that? This infinite, nearly infinite capability we have is based on 12 pitches. The 100,000 word vocabulary that you possess only has 26 units. How many primary colors are there with an infinite number of hues? What are they, six or three? Three primary colors from which all color. This is amazing. This is the way God marries simplicity and complexity. So music is organized pitches in temporal sequence. The rest is culture. One of the greatest quotes in any Western music book that can ever be read is the first sentence of the book on 20th century harmony by Vincent Persichetti, who taught literature and materials of music at Juilliard, and it was a very good composer in his own right. This sentence, when I read it, I thought I'd gone to heaven, at least philosophical heaven, about musical relativity, and music is totally relative. Any tone can succeed any other tone. Any tone can sound simultaneously with any other tone or tones. Any group of tones can be followed by any other group of tones, just as any degree of tension or nuance can occur in any medium under any kind of stress or duration. Period. Second sentence. Successful projection, what we would call beauty or excellence, will depend on the contextual and formal conditions that prevail and upon the skill and the soul of the composer. Isn't that poetic? Isn't that beautiful? In two sentences, Vincent Persichetti took the overtone series, the laws of transmission and retention, the temporality of music, and the worldwide interpretation and the cultural conditions, the skill and the soul of the imago Dei. He put that together into a statement about the absolute relativity of music in such a way as to cause anybody to praise God for that kind of thinking and to go back to his or her drawing board and be as consistent as he or she can with the contextual conditions that prevail and the skill and the soul that they possess. Isn't that a beautiful thing? That ought to be put to an anthem. Not for church. Not for church. But it is so gloriously comprehensive. And it's one of these statements where somebody has fallen over the feet of Jesus and maybe doesn't know it, and has stated a worldwide truth. So remember this as you make music and as you listen to it, whether it's from Namibia or New Guinea or the ghetto or from Leipzig or from Augsburg or from Wheaton or from First Presbyterian or St. Mary of the Afterburners in Kansas. Remember this. The reason why I said that is because there are so many St. Mary's colleges, and you'd think that one maybe near an airport would be called the Afterburner. I don't say that in fun. I have so much almost weeping respect for the nuns and the brothers that run small liberal arts Catholic colleges all over the United States. They do incredible work. I discovered that when I was in the National Association of Schools of Music. But whatever music you're talking about, remember this. Here's what it boils down to. You can either state something, you can repeat it, you can vary it, you can develop it, you can do something in contrast to it, and you can restate it. And I don't consider restatement the same as repetition. All musical forms are abstractions that contain the shapes that you make when you state, repeat, vary, develop, contrast, and restate. Now, I'm saying all of that to say that at base, culture as something that is a composite of what we believe and what we think up and make and how we work on the relationship of the two, the artifacts that we make are available to us out of a very simple set of things that God has created that have infinite import or potential. All of those, including the making of music. I'm saying all of that to say that this wonderful Lord of ours, the creator of the universe, knows better than anybody else what the relationship of simplicity to complexity is. And that neither has more virtue than the other, as long as either is done well. So the Amazing Grace and that wonderful tune that Jars of Clay is bringing back in their latest album, where at the bottom it says, Save the Hymnals. Have you seen that album of theirs? And at the bottom on the record liner, Save the Hymnals. They've done this wonderful version of What Can Wash Away My Sins, Nothing But the Blood of Jesus. Four pitches in that tune. When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, four pitches. Do, re, mi, fa. The Bach and B minor Mass, 12 pitches. 12 pitches. Schoenberg's work in 12-tone dodecaphony, 12 pitches. Handle it carefully. It's precious. Precious raw materials. You know what? I'm one lecture behind. No, I really won't get to lecture two till after lunch. But that's okay. That's okay. I want to talk to you a little bit about high culture and low culture, because they have become dirty words in politicized multicultural thinking. And yet each of those terms contains a history of human thought, a history of human action that we need to revisit for the value they contain. So don't think of high as superior and low as inferior any more than you think of the Rocky Mountains as being superior to the plains of Nebraska. Excuse me, Nebraska. Don't think of that, but just think of our inability to find words to say what somebody else maybe later on can say better with words. Let me try to help you through the high culture, low culture thing, because today church music is primarily a function of low culture. Low culture. And my last lecture is going to be on the differences among high culture, pop culture, and mass culture. And we'll get to that eventually. But church music today is primarily a child of popular culture, perhaps more than ever before in history, although popular culture has always played a very vibrant part in church music and a legitimate part in church music. High culture is not just in Western culture, but in China, Egypt, Japan, the Arab nation, the Mideast. I mean, all of these places have had their high culture, enormously rich repertoires of human imagination and making. High culture works this way. High culture is given over more to the intellectual approach to things, to the finessing, to the nuance. High culture demands extensive training. And in the context of that, has generated a body of work that we call classical because it is so refined, it is so finessed, it is so intellectually engaged. Now, remember, I'm not talking about superiority. I'm talking about a way of going about things, a way of going about things with a deep engagement of the intellect, with enormous amounts of training, with enormous amounts of finesse and nuance. Low culture, on the other hand, has less schooling, less finesse. It's rougher and coarser. Don't take those words as bad words. When you think of low culture and you think of rough and coarse, think of good peasant bread. Think of porridges and foods made in a low culture. Think of the foods that have been imagined and made by poor people because they have to use every piece of the animal. You follow that? Absolutely. Absolutely. Where, you know, why do we have biscuits and gravy? Because the meat had to go around. This 2 or 3 ounces of meat had to go around for a family of six. So you make gravy with it. I mean, why do we have head cheese? Because we had to use the ears. And, you know, when we talk low culture, we're talking about these things that come out of the human imagination, but the schooling is not there, the resources might not be there. But we're talking, in all cases, about goodness and integrity. And I want you to knit, if you will, please, in your mind, these cultures, because the interesting thing about low culture and high culture, when you study them correctly, you can't find the seams. You can't find exactly where one stops. This is the end of low culture, and this is the beginning of French cuisine. Let's say, sausage and gravy, French cuisine. You can't find the seams. Another interesting thing about high culture or low culture, when you go to a museum, you find them displayed as wonders of human creativity, as wonders of human integrity. There's something about what I call the creative spectrum, and that's a term I'd like you to sort of get in your minds a little bit. As much as I will defend the use of high and low culture without being pejorative or biased or prejudiced about these terms, I've come to enjoy the term creative spectrum to describe what I've been talking about all morning so far. The creator-creature, Imago Dei thing, the aesthetic impulse, the fact that everybody wants to create as well as they can out of whatever they have around them, irrespective of the training they've had. They have a sense somehow deep down of integrity whereby they want to do things well. I find that the use of the term the creative spectrum explains it better. There is a spectrum of human creativity that is just gorgeous and beautiful. So here are some things to think about. Rather than to think of pop classical or semi-classical or semi-pop or fusion or any of this, all of the, you know, this has come to me lately, and I love it. Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe that's self-adulation. I don't know. But here's what I like to think of now in approaching music. These spectrums, shallow to deep. You will have read this in Unceasing Worship toward the last chapters. Simple to complex. Ornamental to developmental. Familiar to strange. Entertaining to engaging, set apart to coordinated. Now let me explain those. First of all, none of these terms is meant to imply that one term is better than the other. Shallow is not inferior to deep. Simple is not inferior to complex. These are two ends in a spectrum. Okay? Simple to complex, for example. Speaking scripturally, first of all, milk is shallow, meat is deep. Okay? But both are what? Truth. When I listen to a Haydn rondo at the end of one of his symphonies, just romping, stomping stuff, I'm listening to shallow music. Not all classical music is deep music. I'm listening to shallow music. When I listen to pop music and I hear the McCartney tune yesterday, I'm listening to a deep tune. That's probably one of the greatest tunes this century or the 20th century produced yesterday. That is deep compared to, let's say, how much is that doggy in the window? Now, I'm not talking about the lyrics. I'm talking about the tune. So shallow, deep, there's this spectrum in human creativity where we have shallow art and deep art. Some of the deep art can be lousy. Some of the shallow art can be very good. But with shallow art, I don't have to engage myself quite the same way as I do with the deep. Do you follow that? Church music. Think of it that way. The shallow stuff. The deep stuff. Jesus loves me, this I know is shallow. But I still play this in any number of styles. I play it at weddings, funerals. I can't stay away from that. And some of the arrangements I've made of it maybe are deeper than the others. But it's allowed me to say, you know, classical music is just a heck of a lot of fun. Because a lot of it is just plain old shallow. In the same sense that shallow water can be as pure as deep water. It's still water. So that'll help you through the rest of the spectrum. Simple to complex. What can wash away my sins? Nothing but the blood of Jesus is a simple four-pitch tune with amazing genius in its architecture. There's some 12-bar blues, that chord progression is an amazingly nuanced but nonetheless simple chord progression, and the reason why it's turned into a sort of a worldwide passacaglia or chaconne, everybody in the world knows how to do blues, is because there's something about the 1-4-5 and then some of the sub chords that go into the secondary dominance you can work in. There's a way that goes through 12 bars that as you go toward from here to here, it compresses toward the end. The chord progressions they get more and more jammed. And they were sort of lazy and laid out for the first 8 bars. The last 4 bars, it just squeezes like crazy. That's pretty darn smart, and that's why the 12-bar blues sticks around and sticks around and sticks around and sticks around. It's not just because they're suffering. And I don't mean that in the wrong way about the underprivileged people of the Delta. I don't mean it to castigate that. It's been around because somebody in the Delta, somebody understood something about musical architecture without ever going to school, low culture, about harmonic compression that made that thing work and work and work and work. And to this day, none of you should ever get sick of the blues, simply for architectural reasons, if not for stylistic reasons. Simple to complex. So I take complexity. The last movement of Brahms' Fourth Symphony is built exactly the same way 12-bar blues are, except the last movement is a five-major chord progression. And that complex movement, that whole movement is based on X times 5 of that chord repetition. It's very complex. You take the musical offering of Bach or the Goldberg variations of Bach, the art of fugue of Bach. You take Brahms' motets. You take the symphonies of any number of people, and you find incredible complexity that you have to have years of training to decipher. The interesting thing about music is what I call its intellectual humility. You can have wonderfully complex music, and you don't even have to know how the music works to enjoy it. That cannot be said about a philosophical treatise on the color of argyles that Kierkegaard wore when he was depressed. You can get into great detail about a philosophy. Your point. I'm not making fun of this. This is hard to do when you do philosophy that way. But if you drop your pencil, taking notes, you may as well not get on with the rest of the lecture. But when you're listening to a Brahms symphony, something like that with deep intellectual engagement in it, you might fall asleep for 5 minutes and wake up and you say, you know, I don't think I've missed anything. It's so beautiful and it's there. I call it the intellectual humility of music. The intellectual stuff can be so deftly hidden in music, as probably in no other form of human discourse. So ornamental, developmental, this is interesting to think about. Most pop art, most folk art, most jazz is ornamental in this respect. You have a set tune, let's say, rounded binary tune, whatever, let's say Georgia on My Mind, which is another great tune. Georgia on My Mind is rounded binary. Middle section is less important than the A and the return back to A. And the business of, let's say, a combo, Oscar Peterson Trio or Brad Meldow or somebody like that, in doing that is to create a set of variations on that which are basically ornamentations of the harmony, the rhythm, and the melody, in the terms of which, while one person's soloing, the other musicians are not quite as engaged in the process. They're playing the changes, and the rhythm section is... again, I'm not castigating. I'm saying that jazz, most primitive art, most folk art, is ornamental in that respect. Classical music gets into the developmental, metamorphic stuff, where instead of always having to have a tune of such a length, and all the variations are the same length with the same chord changes, you begin with, instead of a tune, it's often a theme, and if it's not a theme, it's a motive, and then for the next 500 measures, you're metamorphosing with that theme, or with that tune, that motive. There's more developmental work in classical music than there is in popular folk or jazz. Again, I'm talking about ends of a spectrum. Classical music does more of all of this, I will say this in defense of classical music, than any other form of music. Because if you listen to an early Mozart variations like the ones on A vous je dirai maman, da da di da 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 di, those are ornamental variations right down to the T with almost no change. But then you listen to the last movement of Prokofiev's Third Piano Concerto, which is second movement, it's a theme and variations, you find the theme is treated at once, and then from then on all the variations are metamorphic. The length of the variation shifts, the chord progressions are different, motivic development, and so on and so forth. Ornamental to developmental. You can guess at the rest. Familiar to strange, entertaining to engaging. The wonderful thing about music is I can come home pooped out from work, mad at all my colleagues at Wheaton for chewing me out because the budget wasn't right and all this kind of thing. And I'm pooped out, mad, tired. I turn on the Bach B minor Mass, and I just say, Lord, let it wash over me. I don't want to think about it. I just want to enjoy it. Entertaining. Nothing at all wrong with entertainment. Nothing at all. It's a great thing. But another time, I put the B minor Mass on, I say, I'm going to engage with this baby. I'm going to think hard while this is playing. I'm going to think about Jesus. I'm going to think about the fugue in the Kyrie. And I'm going to think, I'm going to get into that with my old buddy, and I'm going to sweat with him. Now, here's the point I want to make, and then we're done. What? I know it, because that's a new idea I got since I wrote the book. Yeah, well, set apart and coordinated is this way. Yeah, thanks. Thank you. I appreciate that. Set apart and coordinated works this way. Most church music is coordinated. That is, it's functional. It's coordinated with something else. It's there to serve, as you'll hear me later, another lecture or some digression. You'll hear me say that music is there only to serve the word. The liturgy is there only to serve the word. That's coordinated. Set apart is what you might call music for the sake of music. Not for its own sake, but just it's set apart in that I'm going to engage so deeply with it that I don't want anything else to be involved with it. I'm just going to, it's set apart. That's often called in older terms absolute music, which is not a good term because all music is absolute in the sense that it's absolutely music. So that's what I mean. All church, no church music should ever be for the sake of music. Not really. Set apart in the sense of being sanctified, yes. But I mean, no church music should be set apart to be admired simply for what it is without reference to anything around it. Okay. Now, when I say all of this, here's how I want to end up for you folks who are professionals. I don't care what kind of church music you do, whether it's simple, complex, or anywhere in between, ornamental to develop. What I beg of you is that images of God engaged in the making of music, you will set your lives to engaging in the entirety of the creative spectrum. Not just the simple, not just the ornamental. You know, church music is basically simple, it's basically ornamental, it's basically coordinated, it's basically familiar. I'll say it again later, let me say it now because I don't mind repeating myself. This contemporary traditional stuff is nothing but marsh gas. Because, and I'll tell you why, every kind of church music that you can name is traditional. By that I mean people are already familiar with it before they get to church. They've either gotten familiar with it on the outside, out in culture, or they're familiar with it on the inside through tradition. But they come to the church that has the most familiar music to it. Therefore, all church music is traditional, and all people who come to music to church for the music are traditionalists. I mean, it's very, very simple. And again, listen to this. Contemporary is a new tradition because within the short space of 25 years, it has frozen itself. Here's another interesting thing, and you'll hear this later. The new generation, the second generation of contemporary people, are now looking at the hymn book as new music. They are. Church, we can't get too snobby about this stuff in church. We can get excellent, but not snobby. It is not the end of the world. It is not the beginning of the world. It's a little tiny practitioner sector in the spectrum of human creativity that is primarily based in simplicity, ornamentalism, and familiarism. But what I hope you do first of all, is to honor that and do the best you can with it. Secondly, that your minds and your hearts long for the whole spectrum, the deep and the complex and the strange and the engaging and the set apart.